AJWS.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao opened the New York Stock Exchange. Today, he met with President Bush in a welcoming ceremony at the White House. On his four-day visit to the U.S., the Chinese leader has been all smiles and reassurance, especially on trade. China has undergone a manufacturing and export boom. Its exports to the United States have more than tripled since 1994. From TVs to textiles to toasters, the label is likely to read, "Made in China." But made how? By whom? Under what conditions? And with what implications for American workers? In this hour, On Point, China, the world's workshop. China, the world's sweatshop. We begin in Washington, where the Chinese premier met with President Bush earlier today. Edward Alden is Washington correspondent for the Financial Times. I asked him what Wen Jiabao's main message has been on his U.S. tour.
I think with respect to trade, the main message has been that China is a free trader, and he's come to the U.S. to warn the Americans not to take actions that would block the import of Chinese products, and to try to encourage the United States to work cooperatively with China to resolve any differences that they have with respect to trade. It's an interesting kind of reversal of roles, because historically, of course, the U.S. has been the strongest advocate for free trade, but the Chinese have become such a competitive economy that Wen Jiabao is able to come over here and, in effect, take the moral high ground by advocating very strongly for expanded trade between the two countries.
Of course, the trade balance is radically in China's favor now.
Absolutely, no question. $103 billion last year, likely to be considerably larger than that this year. And he acknowledged that this is a point of tension between the two countries, and said China is prepared to take concrete steps to try to reduce its trade surplus with the U.S. by buying American aircraft, by buying agricultural products, by trying to open its markets more rapidly to U.S. goods. So he's trying to reassure the U.S. there that the Chinese recognize this is a political problem here for President Bush, and that they're prepared to deal with it in some fashion.
What do we know about his meeting with President Bush today? How did it go?
Well, most of it was actually focused on Taiwan. The trade issue was not the top of the agenda. I think on trade matters, it was all reasonably conciliatory. There was a very interesting discussion on Taiwan. The president publicly this morning delivered a very strong rebuke to the Taiwanese, warning them not to take steps that would make it appear that Taiwan wants independence from China. And that was very much the focus of the conversations between the two men at the White House this morning.
The U.S. is now rather dependent on China, isn't it, for the flow of capital? The Chinese buy a lot of U.S. dollars. They help deal with that big U.S. deficits in many ways.
Well, I think the dependencies run deeper than that. That's certainly part of it. The Chinese, like the Japanese before them, hold a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds, and so have some influence in terms of keeping interest rates low in the U.S., which is important to homeowners and obviously important to this administration politically. But I think, the visit shows that the very conciliatory line that President Bush has taken towards the Chinese with respect to Taiwan, and really siding very heavily with the Chinese in the most important foreign policy issue for the Chinese, the status of Taiwan, I think that just indicates how much the U.S. recognizes China's new power and the need to try to maintain close and strong relations with Beijing.
Apart from debt and treasury bonds, how else does President Bush feel that power acutely?
I think certainly with respect to U.S. companies that have invested heavily in China, and on the trade front, he's trying to walk a very fine line between recognizing that there are concerns among small manufacturers here and among workers about jobs being lost because of competition from China. But on the other hand, the big multinational companies, the big contributors to his campaign, are all heavily invested in China. So there are real limits to how far he can take a kind of populist line in bashing the Chinese on trade issues.
So what is Wen Jiabao suggesting that the Chinese may buy to help balance that trade imbalance to some extent?
Part of it is big ticket items like aircraft. Some of it is agriculture, because obviously that's politically important in the U.S. He's also, interestingly, making a big deal out of U.S. controls on exports of high technology goods. There are a lot of advanced machinery, computer equipment, things that we don't sell to the Chinese because we're worried that they're going to contribute to Chinese military power or they may get sent to unfriendly regimes like the North Koreans. And so there are a lot of things that Americans can't sell to the Chinese. Wen Jiabao came and made a very strong statement that these are anachronistic. China's a friend. The U.S. should remove these export controls in the interests of helping its own sales to China. So that is going to be a very contentious point between the two countries because it's really where lingering security concerns over China overlap with trade issues and our desire to sell more to China.
But Wen Jiabao is saying, yes, you have things we'd like to buy. They're very sophisticated. Make them available to us.
Absolutely. That's precisely what he's saying. He's saying, you know, there are a lot of controls that the U.S. has that makes it impossible for us to buy these goods. We want to buy them, make them available, and that will help deal with the problem of the Chinese trade surplus.
What kind of reception is Wen Jiabao getting in the U.S.? Is there a consensus that the world economy is big enough for these two countries?
I think so. I mean, on both sides, I think he's generally received a very warm reception. I think, unlike a lot of Chinese leaders in the past, he's striking all the right sort of conciliatory notes. He's sophisticated in recognizing the domestic political concerns in this country and trying to respond to them. So I think generally the reception has been very favorable, and I think there's hope, in New York where he was yesterday and in Wall Street circles and here in Washington as well, that whatever differences there are on the economic front, that the two countries can handle them peacefully and that there are, in fact, a lot of overlapping interests. I mean, these are, after all, the only two economies in the world that are really growing at any significant pace. They're the two engines of the world economy, and so I think they see a common interest there.
And when the Chinese premier sees his country described on the front page of the New York Times as the world's sweatshop, do he and other Chinese economic officials take umbrage at that, or do they say, well, yes, we're developing, this is a phase of our development, we'll get past it?
It's very much the latter. You know, they used to take great umbrage at this. I mean, you can remember the human rights debates of the 1990s, and certainly sweatshops were one of the things that was talked about at that time. But I think increasingly their response is, well, you know, we're a changing economy, and we have surplus labor, and yes, conditions may not be as good as we would like to see them, but they will improve over time. And generally, that message has been pretty acceptable in the U.S. Obviously, there are a lot of people in the labor unions and the student movement and elsewhere who are pretty troubled by this. But, in official Washington and among business groups, I think everybody is willing to accept that explanation and nod sagaciously and move on.
So all in all, a pretty smashing visit by Wen Jiabao.
Pretty successful, I would say. Yeah. I mean, the Chinese have to be very happy with the reception that he's received here.
Edward Alden, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Edward Alden is Washington correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about China's manufacturing boom, life inside that boom, and the global implications of China, the world's workshop, China, the world's sweatshop. Do Wen Jiabao's smiling face and soothing words put you at ease? Are China's economic interests now in harmony or conflict with U.S. interests? Are China's working conditions your problem? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Beijing is Joseph Kahn, Beijing Bureau Chief for the New York Times and author of The World's Sweatshop, a series about hazards facing industrial workers in China. Good evening here. Good morning there in China. Joseph Kahn, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And also with us tonight from New York is Pete Engardio, Senior International News Editor at Business Week magazine. Good evening and welcome, Pete Engardio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Good evening. Good morning. We're all over the planet tonight. Joe Kahn, to you first. In Beijing, you've put together quite a series this year on working conditions in China. The consistent logo here has been the world's sweatshop. Make the case that this is more than a bounteous workshop, that it's a sweatshop. What's the picture that's emerged from your reporting?
Well, the Chinese economy has a number of different things going on. I mean, it's not all monolithic. It's clearly not all a sweatshop. But I think it's significant for Americans and other Westerners to think about some of the conditions where the main Chinese exports come from. When we talk about the main Chinese exports, we're talking about apparel and textiles and shoes and toys and sporting goods, and then moving up into sort of mid-range electronics like televisions and VCRs and DVD players. And those are made very largely by a class of people in China who are not the main beneficiaries of the economic reform program. They're made by peasants for the most part. They're migrant workers who come from all over the country to the main industrial centers in the south and the in the Yangtze River Delta region around Shanghai, and are the main sort of manufacturing staff workers in foreign-invested and also Chinese-owned companies that produce mainly for the export market. So almost everything that you see with a Made in China label, and there are clearly some exceptions, some high-end exceptions, but the vast majority of what you see is made by peasant laborers, and peasant laborers in China really do not have status in the society. When they migrate to the cities, they are not treated as full residents of those cities. They don't have rights to get housing. They don't have automatic access to medical care. They can't send their children to schools. And more than that, I think, and most significantly, they are treated as expendable sort of tools of production. If they get injured or they get tired or whatever, they are dismissed and sent home. There's no lingering implications. China's made a fairly explicit choice not to allow independent labor unions to represent these workers or any other workers. And so a lot of the products that have made China's economy grow as quickly as it does are made under conditions that not only probably would not be acceptable in the U.S. today, that's for sure, but probably would not be acceptable in the U.S. 70 or even 80 years ago.
Joseph Kahn, give us a sense of those conditions. What have you seen inside Chinese workplaces that justifies the label world's sweatshop?
I think probably the one element that kind of ties it together broadly across the spectrum, because obviously even within the sort of the export, the low-end export sector, there's a wide variety of factories, some of them actually sort of well-lit and modern and in some cases partially mechanized and that kind of thing. What probably ties it together is extremely low level of attention to China's own labor laws in terms of length of working hours, length of overtime, overtime pay, and beyond that, the living conditions for workers, these temporary migrant laborers at the factory, often within the factory, often just outside the factory, are pretty poor. So you have conditions that probably, you know, there's no technical definition of a sweatshop, I don't think, but the it would be sweatshop conditions anywhere in the West, which doesn't mean that in all cases every factory has atrociously bad conditions, but they are the factories are designed for a very high rate of production with very long hours, with workers who are not going to complain about any of those factors. And if they do complain, they'll lose their jobs quickly.
Joe Kahn, stand by there for just a moment. I want to turn to Pete Ingardio in New York for a second. Pete, what's your sense of this? You've probably read some of Joe's work this year in the Times from China. You have your own Business Week reporters there as well. You've seen plenty of their reporting. Is this something outrageous? Is this just the rung on the ladder, the same one that's been climbed by Taiwan, Hong Kong, South Korea, Singapore? Is this just a passage that every developing economy goes through? What do you make of it?
Well, as Joe says, it's not a monolithic situation, and it's no one simple answer. But certainly what Joe's been reporting is true from what we know. And the stories we've done over the years about sweatshops in China, they're very real, as Joe says. There are conditions in China, and that would not be that really had to go back to the era of the Triangle Fire, Triangle Building fire
in New York
century.
City. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, these are that bad. You know, locking up women in factory floors, making them sleep in extremely crowded dormitory rooms. They get ripped off left and right with all sorts of fees. Now, that's the worst of it, and no doubt this is getting. This is not going away, that the extreme cost pressure that Walmart, Target, and everybody else puts on their suppliers, which grows more and more acute every year. They get passed on, the savings get passed on to American consumers.
So the Chinese feel that cost pressure too. Pete Ingardio, stand by. Joseph Kahn in Beijing. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about China, the world's workshop, China, the world's sweatshop. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China, the world's workshop, China, the world's sweatshop. We're joined tonight from Beijing, China, by Joseph Kahn, Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been putting out a series of articles looking into Chinese workplaces all this year. We're joined from New York by Pete Ingardio, senior international news editor at Business Week magazine. You can join the conversation as well. When you turn your holiday gifts upside down, what percent say made in China? Do you already presume that China will be an economic superpower? And what about the condition of its workers along the way? Do Premier Wen Jiabao's smiling face and soothing words put you at ease about the Chinese challenge? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pete Ingardio, I'm sorry I had to cut you off.
That's okay.
You were just talking about the cost pressure that the Chinese feel, not from, I guess it's all competition, but they're feeling it directly from big American distributors like Walmart.
Absolutely. And where we left off is when I just got to the however part.
Mm-hmm.
The however part is that you also will find lots of factories in China that are as good as you will find in certainly any developing nation, and that are making they're not unlike the factories you would have seen outside of Malaysia, run by Motorola or Texas Instruments or in Singapore.
And are these foreign owned or Chinese owned or both, Pete?
Mainly foreign owned, Western, which is, well, you have to understand, 65% of China's exports to the United States is by American companies.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Motorola, we're talking about Delphi Auto Parts, we're talking about Flextronics that makes all the Xboxes,
mm-hmm.
most of the Palm Pilots.
Mm-hmm.
These factories, the ones that I've been in, are very good factories and certainly very, very extremely good on Chinese standards. They're every bit as good as the ones you would have found in South Korea at this stage of development. Well, they're probably better. General Electric just opened. I'm not sure if you've been up in that one, but General Electric just kind of unveiled its huge high-tech center in Shanghai.
Joe Kahn, I don't know if you've seen that, Joe Kahn. You might let us know, but you've written about how things are not always quite what they seem. You had a story just recently in the paper about Etch-a-Sketch officials visiting China. The classic American toy used to be built in Ohio. Now it's built in China. You might tell us, share with us what they found when they visited the factory and what the facts were.
The inspections that I wrote about were not necessarily performed by Etch-a-Sketch. Actually, I think the inspections that I wrote about in the course of that story, but I'll tell you from the top.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fairly good, like Pete was describing, clearly there is a fairly big sector of the economy that is foreign invested and that at least seeks to adhere nominally to international labor standards. And I think what this piece pointed out was that sometimes appearances are deceptive. I think that there is a fairly explicit effort on the part of a lot of Hong Kong Taiwanese and some local Chinese companies to make it appear as though they are adhering to sort of basic labor standards and Chinese labor laws, in order to avoid scrutiny from clients who demand such things. And it is true that most big American clients, including, very notably Walmart, demand that their suppliers in China obey all local Chinese laws. And Chinese laws, if you look at them literally, are pretty complete. They demand a 40-hour work week,
mm-hmm.
and they cap overtime per month at 32 hours, and they require double time if you work on weekends. And
so the laws look good. But, Joe, tell us about some of the gyrations that folks at the Kinki Industrial Plant in Shenzhen, China, went through when it came time for them to be inspected.
When it came time for inspections at Kinki, they basically passed out crib sheets to the supervisors and to the workers, telling them what they should say if they are chosen for spot interviews by the inspectors. And they're told essentially to lie. They're told that to tell the inspectors that their wage rates are about 40% higher than they really are. They're told to say that they don't have any more than the maximum number of overtime hours permitted by law. They're told to say that their dormitories are comfortable. They're told to say that the food is good. They're told basically to paint a portrait of a fairly complete, you know, and comfortable sort of notion of welfare, worker welfare in a factory to satisfy the inspectors. But none of it is true. The workers know it's not true. They don't like having to do this, but the factory offers them 200 yuan in bonuses. If they're interviewed and they give the correct answers to the questions of inspectors, they get what for them is a very significant amount of money, $30 or so. It might be a couple weeks' pay even.
So they've got a real incentive there. Joe, what percentage, you said a percentage of the industrial economy there does adhere to international standards. What percentage would that be, and what percentage from your reporting would you say is below, is sweatshop distance below?
Absolutely impossible for me to say. I wish I could give you a clearer answer. I mean, I think it's clearly true, as Pete said, that you see a pretty wide spectrum. I don't believe that GE itself is running something that would be classified as a sweatshop. But I think there are a lot of things in the middle ground. What we talk about as being this big foreign invested sector has an extremely wide range. From, you know, absolute top-notch wafer fabs run by Intel or Motorola to extremely low-end sweatshops run out of the back of somebody's home, which are run by some sort of Taiwan or Korean or Hong Kong-funded enterprise. And it's very difficult to say when sweatshop ends and normal factory life begins, because I think to a certain extent in the middle range, you do see some of these deceptions that might take a factory that looks pretty good on the surface and even on a quick inspection tour would seem to be pretty decent. But when you really probe under the surface and talk to the workers, you find out there are some things going on there that are more repressive than you could see on a kind of a quick foreign inspection tour.
Okay, so there's a checkered picture here, and we get it, and it can be pretty decent, and it can be pretty bad. Pete Ngardio, help us put this into kind of context to understand it. I mean, every developing economy, as we said earlier, has gone through a tough stretch. It's true in the tigers along the Pacific Rim there. It was true of the United States at one time. Our factories were hardly paradises a century and more ago. But here you've got China with all this development along that industrialized coast and that huge interior with, you know, just a vast population, peasant population, as Joseph Kahn calls them. What does that mean for the world labor market? Can China just endlessly draw peasants out of that very low-income interior to feed the low price demands, cost demands of Walmart and other distributors?
I'll tell you what makes China different than most of the other East Asian countries that went up this ladder is that they went through a Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Malaysia, went through extremely low-end basic assembly work in the course of like a decade or two.
Mm-hmm.
Before late wages started rising there, they started actually running out, you know, started getting short of production workers. I mean, Singapore had to start pushing labor-intensive factories out. So did Malaysia 5-6 years ago, just because they didn't have the workforce. They need to redeploy the workers. China has been going at this almost 20 years now, doing Barbie doll kind of production. At the same time, it's doing extremely sophisticated stuff. But at the same time, it's been able to hold on to this really, you know, the garment work to where it's nobody in the Caribbean can really compete. You know, when they take off textile, remove the textile quota system in 2005, the estimate is that China's share of the global textile market is going to go from 25% to 40%.
It's incredible.
Because it's so competitive. And even countries with lower wages can't compete.
But what does it mean, Pete,
that they had this – yeah, back to your question.
Yeah.
As Joe says, a lot of these workers are usually women, and they're drawn from the interior provinces, not from Guangdong province itself anymore, where wages have risen a lot, or
this
Shanghai.
Is near Hong Kong, where a big industrial area, yep.
They're then housed in huge dormitories owned by the companies. And when the women are there for 2 or 3 years and they want to, they've saved their money, they go back home, or they're pushed back home. and they bring in a fresh supply. And when the certain areas get tapped out, they seem to find there's China has 800 million, something like that. Correct me, Joe, if I'm wrong. Peasants, you know. And
exactly. We've got that picture. But what does that mean? Does it mean that China could ultimately kind of make
for a long time?
Well, could it make everything for the world? And when you put that huge population, relatively poor, together with that coastal, sophisticated manufacturing base, could China essentially make everything the world needs? And what does that mean for the rest of the global labor market?
Gosh, you know, I guess theoretically it can make almost everything. It doesn't. China is still half world away. And so a lot of goods are very expensive to put onto a boat, and you just can't put them on an airplane. China is not going to be exporting in big quantities refrigerators to the United States.
Well, they're talking about furniture now, very serious thrust on furniture,
true.
I see.
It's true. Very, very labor-intensive, and also the raw materials are out there. But no, that's true. I mean, they are making a tremendous amount, and in terms of electronics, it's a formidable production base, because what's happened is...
Let me add something to what
Yes, Joe Kahn, please.
Because I think the, I think that's an important question as to sort of when the limit is hit here, and it reflects one of the reasons that China has continued to expand its export-oriented production as much as it has, is that, first of all, they do have this sort of, as Pete was describing, this deep bench of peasants.
To I mean, say the least,
first,
yeah.
The first wave were willing to work for conditions that others in Asia thought were probably not acceptable. But then they have this entire interior that thinks that that initial wave on the East Coast had it great, and they're willing to come in and work for even less money and even sort of worse terms on their work contracts and things like that. But I think beyond that, The system that China has set up is extremely regressive in terms of labor rights and opportunities. So I think it's enormously significant. It's basically one line in every story that I've written, but it's enormously significant that these workers are not allowed to unionize.
And you're saying because that's another way that some kind of bottom could be put under this, but the political system in China does not permit it.
Basically, every place else, and of course around Asia, unions have never had the full rights that they had in the West. But if you look at South Korea or Malaysia or or Taiwan or most of the other major export powers around Asia, there was representation of workers. There certainly is in Japan and South Korea.
So, Joe, the same question to you then. Where does this go?
Well, I mean, I guess you could hypothetically imagine a scenario in 10 years in which China has sort of a majority share in basically every major manufactured good. But the only way that they would be able to do that is if they continue to put or allow companies to demand absolute lowest prices. I mean, China has to continue to produce these goods at the lowest world price. The moment they begin moving upscale, if they really start protecting their workers or demanding better conditions for them or the like, or their infrastructure gets maxed out, or their taxes rise too high, I mean, there's a variety of other cost factors.
Sure, sure.
It will instantly move. I mean, there's no loyalty to this market. I mean, if somebody can make something in Bangladesh for 20% cheaper in China, and in garments that's already beginning to be true, mm-hmm. it will shift. I don't think that China – there's no threat here or fear of China somehow monopolizing all the manufactured goods in the world, and that everything we make will say made in China, and suddenly they can – sort of control the world economy. I think we're long past that.
So nothing is forever, even that deep exploitable bench in China. A lot of people want to join us. Let me turn to the phones. Miro is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Miro. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Thanks. I wanted to just make a few points, and actually our host made a very good point, which I wanted to make, which is that, at one point we were also the world sweatshop. We shouldn't forget the factory fires that we were having during our Industrial Revolution.
Plenty of textile workers in the good old USA a century and more ago.
That's right. So in effect, we're asking China to uphold labor standards that we hold now, but which we did not hold during our time as a manufacturing center.
Though Miro, Pete was saying that even 70 or 80 years ago, you might have had better standards in the U.S. than you've got in China today. I just say that as an aside. But your main point?
Okay, well, the main point is that the sweatshop comment, I think, is disrespectful, almost patronizing language. Basically, what I think the point of the article is that China's becoming the manufacturing center of the world, and you know, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that China will be the world's largest economy in this century. I think a lot of economists agree on that. I think slighting them shows, you know, some poor long-term judgment. I believe that if anything, if we're going to complain about loss of manufacturing jobs, we should really think about union busting practices in this country and the fact that our corporations really wanted to cut costs by going to places like China, Hungary, Mexico. We, you know, free trade is an export of Western capitalism, which we exported, and this is one of the fruits of it. And
okay, Miro, let us pick it up. And Joe Kahn, first to you. Miro says, hey, in labeling this the world sweatshop, you are patronizing. You are disrespectful. This is sliding China. What are you really getting at with that label, with the thrust of the series, Joe?
Well, the series is not intended to be prescriptive. We're not.
But you're looking to illuminate something.
Solutions. Yeah. I think that there is a. I think if it, sort of my bottom line in this is actually, I would dispute slightly the way the caller characterized it. What I think the bottom line here is pointing out that in this enormously important sector of the Chinese economy, that produces most of what we wear and most of what we play baseball with and bowl with and everything else, that many of the factories that operate here are not only not adhering to the standards of the United States today,
mm-hmm.
they're not adhering to the standards of the United States at the time that we had sweatshops, and they're not adhering to China's own labor laws. That's a very important final point. China has laws on the books. They nominally are a socialist country that protects and cares for its workers. In fact, waged a revolution on behalf of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
But the foreign invested companies that have come in particular, and some Chinese companies as well, do not adhere to those standards. So China is turning a blind eye to its own labor laws, and I think that is a significant factor in its competitiveness worldwide.
And Pete Ingardio, off of Miro's comment as well, how do you see the needle moving here? Is China kind of dragging down the global labor uplift factor?
Well, let me we're going to go around in circles on that, but if I just add another dimension here,
yeah.
It's not just about labor. It's just not only about labor. The China in In China, and let's take electronics, where China is now surpassed Taiwan as an exporter in electronic products. It's making,
in volume.
Compared to like no laptop, no notebook computers about 3 or 4 years ago, it's now making over the half of those sold in the United States.
Wow.
It's an enormous production base for cell phones that are sold here, whether they're under, you know, whoever's brand name is on. And this is not only because of labor. It's because China has the world's biggest components infrastructure. Every little widget you need to make a cell phone, to make a motherboard for a computer, is made in China.
Also, so we've got to take a break, but we've got it. It's not just the labor, it's the components as well. What a picture. We're talking tonight about China, the world's workshop. Are China's economic interests and America's in harmony or conflict? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China, the world's workshop. China, as the New York Times would have it, as the world's sweatshop. Our guests are Joseph Kahn, Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times and author of the series The World's Sweatshop, about hazards facing industrial workers in China. From New York, Pete Engardio, senior international news editor at Business Week magazine. You can join the conversation as well. Do you care where your toaster, your Etch-a-Sketch were made? Are Chinese working conditions your problem? And is there enough work on this old planet for Chinese workers and American workers? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jean's calling from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Hi, Jean. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I'm just calling because I'm hearing that, I mean, even if in China, the best case scenario is that everybody's lifestyle improves a little bit. Well, if in America we already use one-fourth of the world's resources, and if there's this problem with global warming, and we're getting these people to where they have millions more cars, I mean, either we're not we're not really being honest, and we're just going to keep them all as zombie slaves, or else we're just going to destroy the world.
So you think better off if the peasants just drive the donkey and not a six-cylinder Chinese automobile?
Well, I mean, do we believe in global warming? Do we believe that America uses too much of the resources for its population?
And if everybody aspires to that standard, yeah, we know that argument, but let's see what our guests have to say about it, Gene. Thanks for your call. Joe Kahn, how about it? What about first of all, just the environmental side of China's industrial production? Have you looked at that? And what about it if they break through here and stop making rock-bottom wages and start making the good life and driving the big car? What happens?
Well, it's already happening. The sort of the urban middle class sector of the Chinese economy is growing very quickly and doing very well, and is beginning to purchase Western style consumer goods at an astounding rate. Automobile sales are growing in the high double digits, 70-80% a year.
Wow!
All the big automakers are there. They're building highways. They're going to have a highway system that's more extensive than America's if they complete their plan over the next 10 years. It's an enormous consumer-driven economy domestically in China, and they're very much buying into the American dream. I do think that in the immediate future, however, the class of workers that we've been talking about in the first part of this program are not major beneficiaries of this.
But what about the environmental impact of this step up generally?
The environmental impact here is overwhelming and obvious. I mean, the cities are for the most part badly polluted. The air is dirty. The Yellow River no longer runs to the sea. China's contributing heavily to global warming. It has a huge number of environmental problems that it recognizes and would like to begin fighting, and has taken some steps. But it's a little bit like the labor problem for them, in that, as you said at the top of the program, they see this as something which is just something that will be overcome in the course of development.
Overcome, but the U.S. is much developed and still, a polluter in its own right. I mean, is it possible to have a billion-plus Chinese climbing on up the ladder and not have it turn into a scale-tipping environmental factor?
I think China would be thrilled to be where the U.S. is today environmentally. I think if you travel around China and see what the environmental conditions are here, the U.S. looks pristine. None of its cities are anywhere near as polluted as the major Chinese cities. In other words, the U.S. has, through the course of development, moved out of the dirtiest industries, and many of them have moved to places like China. China's still burning coal as its main source of energy. The coal is still untreated in many of its power plants. China's at a very early stage of beginning to tackle its big environmental problems. I think my gut instinct on this is that they're a little bit they're on slightly solider ground when they talk about the environment being a price of development than they are when they talk about labor being a price of development.
Or labor exploitation. And Pete Engardia, what's your sense? Should an American green hope for China to climb right on up that development ladder, or hope that several hundred million of those folks stay on the farm?
Oh, I just, it's just not our decision to make.
Oh, of course not. But
I'm not going to contest anything that Joe said. It just sounds exactly what I've read and seen. I haven't been there for a while, but environmental situation sounds grim. But the U.S. isn't the best leader, isn't the best role model when it comes to the global warming issue. We should have signed that darn treaty, and we'd have had a little bit more standing, at least to press it. And obviously, we're much better shape than China is, but
there's a kind of presumption in the point in the conversation we've come to that they're, that this has to end up a net loss somehow. But of course, there's a development path that people see as leading beyond belching smokestacks to something cleaner. That there could be an ultimate win-win here.
I only leave that for Joe to kind of assess how China's doing, because
I think you're right, and I think that China does see itself as basically being able to grow out of this. I think that for example, Beijing is going through the phase now of preparing for the 2008 Olympics, and the quality of the air in Beijing is a major concern for the planners of the Olympics. So they're taking a variety of steps to improve things. I mean, they are implementing standards for automobile fuel, for example. They're eliminating coal burning for heat in the major buildings in Beijing. They will put very sharp restrictions on traffic in the run-up to the Olympics. They have the power to do things about the environment here that can make a very visible difference very quickly. They can make sweeping decisions. They don't have the same sort of difficult kind of lobbying and democratic process that we do in the United States.
So the same politics to keep labor down might be able to clean the environment up. Habu is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Habu. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening to all of you.
Good evening.
Two very quick points. First point was, you know, just when President Bush came into the administration, I remember him hearing him say that he would attack China if they attacked Taiwan.
Yeah, he was very tough on that.
He was very, and also the incident with the spy plane.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of testing the waters. Have I missed something, or what has happened since 9/11? Has China become our nearest ally? And that's the first point. The second point
because
is
because President Bush, of course, today was very strong in the opposite direction, saying basically we don't want to get in between you guys and Taiwan. We want to stay out of it almost.
Which almost begs the question: what is this policy all based on? The United States. I mean, we choose our enemies, and then all of a sudden we just kind of. But anyway, my second
well, power
point,
is shifting with economics here, Habu. That has to be a factor at some level, doesn't it?
Yes, but you know, he just came in and then he chose to kind of test the waters with China. I mean, this is almost reckless, I would think.
And your second point?
My second point is, you know, this whole thing about globalization, and I do not begrudge China or India or,
sure,
or Bangladesh.
Good luck to them.
But it is, yes, good, and they're doing what they have to do. But this is a real repudiation of what has gone on in this country, the sweat of people, of labor people, the Clean Water Act, the fair labor laws, the you know, providing for unemployment insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By businesses going abroad and leaving workers high and dry in this country, it is a real repudiation and a slap in the face of working people. And I don't know how they keep on buying these things from there. You know, when you described about these dorms and all, this could have been some of these railroad towns in the 20s or 30s in the United States.
Sleeping head to toe and elbow to elbow. Our time's running down, but thanks for your call, Habu. Peter Engardio, what about the implications here for the U.S. economy and for U.S. workers? If there's no bottom under Chinese labor in terms of their entitlements, their ability to organize, to join unions and the rest, the exports,
you know,
are pouring out. What are the implications?
The stuff that China is making, the kind of industries that it's really dominant have long gone in the United States. There are still some textile jobs, but they're dramatically down. And it's getting to the, you know, it's there is some need for a garment industry in the United States.
I don't think all these jobs left years ago. I mean, we lost 2.7 million just in what, the last year or two? It just gets left a handful of years ago.
It's been a long, long, steady slide.
The trend,
certainly. It's a very small fraction of this stuff that we're competitive in. We're still competitive in some garments because they're fashion sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, T-shirts, regular Oxford dress shirts are not what we make in this country anymore. They're not going to come back. They aren't going to come back. And the shoe industry is not going to come back. The low-end furniture industry is not going to come back. If it's not China, it's going to be Central America. It's going to be the Caribbean. It's going to be Bangladesh, India, Vietnam, Indonesia. These are labor-intensive industries where you're never going to get you're never going to bridge the kind of wage gap that you're talking about with most of these heavily populated developing countries. I don't think this is where the impact is. And it's a net benefit to us because we can buy a lot more of this stuff than we ever could.
Well, good for all of us when we're buying. Not so good for those who depended on those jobs. We are out of time. Pete Engardio in New York, thank you very much for joining us tonight from Business Week. And Joseph Kahn in Beijing, thanks very much for your work and your time with us this evening. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, how the natural world is handling the major snowstorms that have been hitting much of the nation. This is On Point. A powerful storm is sweeping the plains and the upper Midwest today. Nearly a foot of snow has fallen in western Nebraska, and winter storm warnings are posted from Kansas to Wisconsin. Over the weekend, an early blast dumped up to 2 feet of snow across much of the Northeast. For most humans, blizzards mean cold toes and sore backs from shoveling. But for the rest of the natural world, winter snows present bigger challenges. Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focus Guides series, the palm-sized guides you see tucked in the vests of bird watchers and nature lovers. Tonight, Ken Kaufman peers under the snow to see how the rest of the natural world is coping with this week's winter storms.
Travelers stranded at closed airports or homeowners shoveling out their driveways were not the only creatures affected by the storm this weekend. Even as the snow was falling, naturalists were pausing to consider how the birds and other animals were faring in this weather. Some creatures deal with winter weather by avoiding it altogether. The eastern chipmunks that were so active and conspicuous during the warmer months are now underground, not actually hibernating, but dozing, waking up every few days to munch on the nuts and other provisions that they stored in their burrows during the fall. The groundhogs are underground as well, in a deep hibernation, surviving on the fat that they stored up by eating your vegetable garden last summer. They're not likely to wake up anytime soon, not even on February 2nd, regardless of what our traditions might suggest. Many of the songbirds have avoided winter by migrating away from it. The scarlet tanagers that sang in the oak woodlands of New England during the summer are all in the rainforests of the Amazon basin now. The orioles have abandoned Baltimore and most other parts of the U.S., and they are mostly in Mexico or Central America by now. However, there are still dozens of bird species that are permanent residents of the colder regions. Theirs is a different strategy. They avoid the hazards of migration, and instead they deal with the hazards of winter. The key factor for many is not temperature, but food. Many birds can survive extreme cold as long as they get enough to eat. For juncos, sparrows, and other thick-billed birds, the seeds of grasses and weeds are the main items on the winter menu. Heavy snowfall makes it harder for the birds to find seeds on the ground, and they may have to spend more energy scratching through the snow or seeking out sheltered spots where the standing dead weeds have not been buried. Then there are birds that forage up in trees. These include some of the most conspicuous birds of winter woodlands, traveling in noisy little flocks. Black-capped chickadees are the leaders of the flocks, flitting about like acrobats among the outer twigs of trees. Usually the chickadees are joined by downy woodpeckers, hitching their way up tree trunks and probing for insects below the bark. White-breasted nuthatches, stubby little birds that walk down trees head first, and brown creepers, creeping along like bits of bark that have come to life. Since they are up in the trees, snowfall has not made their food much harder to find. The one kind of winter storm that can cause serious problems for birds is an ice storm. When freezing rain coats the trees and the ground with a layer of ice, all of their normal food supplies may be locked away and inaccessible. But when a winter storm consists merely of snow, even a 2-foot snow, most birds will come through just fine. Perhaps a little hungrier than usual, perhaps a little irritated or uncomfortable, but basically no more inconvenienced by the weather than we were.
Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focus Guide series. He spoke with us from Tucson, Arizona. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.